And a bit of good news, Ireland now says the air has cleared enough there to reopen airports in Dublin and Cork. Forecasters can predict where that cloud of ash will spread, but scientists can't say how long the eruption will last. It could actually continue to spew forth ash on and off for months, and it could trigger an even bigger eruption of an even bigger volcano nearby. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Because volcanic ash can cause extensive damage to jets, even bring them out of the sky, weather bureaus around the world have scientists who specialize in following volcanic clouds. Greg Galina works at the Washington Volcanic Ash Advisory Center in Camp Springs, Maryland, and he's been watching the Icelandic fallout carefully.
The nature of the ashes is pretty typical.
The particles spewing forth from the Icelandic volcano are mostly microscopic bits of glass. They're hazardous because they can easily melt onto jet engine parts, block intake lines, ding windshields, and scour aircraft bodies.
What makes this one really special is the location at which it's erupting.
Of course, that's because Europe's busy air corridors are downwind. The volcano itself is no big deal. Galina says there have actually been several much bigger eruptions in the past few years, off in the Aleutian Islands and in Russia. Satellites pick up information about these ash clouds. Some instruments can even see what they're made of. And forecasters can even get a pretty good idea about where they're heading, just as they forecast the weather.
It is actually quite like the weather because of the fact that these particles are very small. You can actually trace them along through the wind.
Once a cloud is in the air, forecasters can keep planes away. The trick comes in figuring out what's going to happen next with the source of these clouds, the volcanoes themselves. That job is left to geologists on the ground. In this case, Sigrun Heinsdottir and her colleagues at the University of Iceland have been following the activity of the volcano for 3 months. At first, it started with a gentle tourist-style eruption.
Sometimes magma is just beautiful, quiet, bubbly thing that comes out of the ground, and sometimes it's more violent.
In this case, the eruption turned violent when the red-hot magma underground changed course and started coming up directly below a glacier. The mix of magma and ice is explosive. And how long that could last is anyone's guess.
We wouldn't be surprised if it went on for months, but on and off, like we have seen in the last few weeks where it comes up in one location and then it comes up in another location. That didn't surprise us.
Heinsdottir also wouldn't be surprised if the magma from the Eyjafjallajökull volcano crept underground just a bit to the east and flowed into the chambers of its much bigger volcanic neighbor, Katla. That volcano has been unexpectedly quiet in recent decades, and she says an eruption there could trigger much more disruption than what's happening now.
We were just looking at each other this morning when we realized Katla is probably able to do way much more than that. Yeah, I would be worried when Katla goes up.
And she'll also be among the first to know. Richard Harris, NPR News.
President Obama waded into another controversy at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida yesterday, which started when he largely shelved Bush administration plans for a new moon mission. Instead, he has set his sights on Mars. The hope is Mars will pay dividends here on Earth. We have two reports, beginning with NPR's Scott Horsley.
The countdowns at the Kennedy Space Center have a grim finality these days, with just 3 space shuttle flights left. There was no clear plan for what comes next until President Obama splashed down at the Kennedy Space Center yesterday and tried to offer one.
Let me start by being extremely clear. I am 100% committed to the mission of NASA and its future.
That future has been in doubt. In his 2011 budget, Mr. Obama threatened to cancel the overdue, underfunded Constellation program, which President Bush conceived to put a man back on the moon. Mr. Obama's message? Been there, done that.
There's a lot more of space to explore and a lot more to learn when we do.
Instead, the president promised billions of dollars for programs to carry astronauts beyond Earth orbit, eventually to Mars. In the process, the White House says it hopes to turn Florida's I-4 corridor into the Silicon Valley of space. Political scientist Susan McManus of the University of South Florida says that corridor is already known as a political prize in this very important swing state.
Some people will look at it politically, but let me assure you that the people on the Space Coast will be looking at it economically.
The president says his space plan will bring an extra 2,500 jobs to Florida, where the earthbound unemployment rate is the 6th highest in the country. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
For the bankers of Wall Street, the party seems to be on again. This week, one of the biggest banks in the country, J.P. Morgan, announced huge profits for the first quarter. And there are signs the broader economy is recovering. Consumer spending is up. Manufacturing activity is up. The stock market hit 11,000. To find out if this Great Recession is really over, we call David Wessel. He's economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
So, David, who is saying what?
Well, as you may know, the committee of economists who call the start to end in recessions refused this week to say it's over, even though some members of the committee actually think it is. And most economists think the economy started growing again after a long contraction last summer. And there are some encouraging signs. As you said, consumer spending was up significantly in March. Employers finally are hiring more people than they're laying off. But gosh, we're still an awful long way from normal. Unemployment is still 9.7%, and there are even more people who have given up looking for work. Industry as a whole is operating at only 73% of capacity. The average over the last 30 years is about 80%, and the economy is still addicted to the Fed giving away free money, essentially, to the banks.
Well, let's talk about corporate profits, and not just the banks, but other companies. Google has reported strong profits. Do these figures tell us whether we're really recovering?
We're just in the very early days of the season where companies report their earnings. You're right. Google said its profits were up 37% in the first quarter. They say online advertising is coming back. On the other hand, Alcoa, the big aluminum company, which idled one quarter of all its plants in the recession, had a loss for the first quarter, and they're kind of mildly optimistic about the year. The J.P. Morgan thing is really stunning. Profits up 55% from a year ago, largely because of their investment banking business and because they're setting aside less money for deadbeat loans, not because they're making more loans to consumers or businesses. Their CEO, Jamie Dimon, who was very cautious, is talking about what he says the makings of a strong economy. But one thing we're seeing here is we ended this whole crisis with fewer bigger banks, and those bigger banks like J.P. Morgan have a lot of market power. They're able to get more profits because they can charge more for what they do because they have less competition.
You know, David, the phrase Great Recession has really taken hold. And now that it seems to be over, do you think the name fits? Was it the Great Recession?
Well, it certainly was the worst recession we've had since the Great Depression itself. It was longer, industrial production fell more, unemployment didn't get quite as high as it did in the early 80s, but the increase in unemployment from 4.4% to 10.1% is much bigger than we've seen before. Now, what makes a recession great, what gives it that horrible honor, I think, is whether, not whether it's long and deep, but whether it provokes some long-lived changes in the economy. And I frankly think this one is. I think the way that Americans look at business and the rules of finance and how they look at their homes and their retirement plans will change as a result of this. So in my book, yeah, it's the right word to use.
David Wessel, economics editor at the Wall Street Journal. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
There's a new art world documentary called Exit Through the Gift Shop about street artists and the ways in which their renegade work has ended up selling for lots and lots of money. The credited director is the renowned English street artist who calls himself Banksy and whose identity is a matter of much conjecture. So is much else about this movie. Critic David Edelstein has a review.
Okay, this is complicated. The documentary Exit Through the Gift Shop is billed as directed by Banksy, B-A-N-K-S-Y, which is the pseudonym for an incognito British street artist who's been widely denounced, but even more widely celebrated. But the original director, we're told, was a Frenchman living in L.A. named Terry Guetta, who set out to film guerrilla street artists around the world, including the most elusive of them all, Banksy. At some point, Banksy took over the camera, and Terry became the subject. How that flip-flop happened and what happened next is the story of the film. And it's a wonderful, often hilarious film, even if doubts about its authenticity linger. The acid narration is by Welsh actor Rhys Ifans, who explains how unemployed Sad Sack Terry became obsessed with videotaping street artists at their clandestine illegal labors. Among those artists were Terry's cousin, Space Invader, known for affixing Space Invader video game images to walls and bridges, Shepard Fairey, who'd break through to the mainstream with his Obama posters, and finally, Banksy himself. Banksy appears on camera, sort of. He's in silhouette, under a hoodie, his voice distorted. After he explains why Terry's videotaping is important, Terry himself speaks.
Most normal art is built to last, like, hundreds of years. It's cast in bronze or it's oil on canvas, but street art has a short lifespan, so it needed documenting. You know, we all needed someone who knew how to use a camera.
I wanted to make a movie about street art. So I wanted to get as much people as possible. He was like more than any drugs to anybody. He was obsession.
Like other New Yorkers, I lived for more than a decade staring at buildings and subways covered with eyesore graffiti. So my view of so-called street art is relativist. If it's good, it justifies the vandalism. If it isn't, throw him in jail. But there's no doubt about Banksy's art. As shown in Terry's footage, his satirical assaults on politics, culture, and capitalism in settings as various as the alleyways of London, the barrier wall in the West Bank, and the rides of Disneyland are provocations of genius. He became the director of this film, he says, when Terry took more than 1,000 hours of tapes and edited them into a hash, a barrage of images with no connective tissue, or as Banksy puts it, the work of someone with mental problems, an unimaginable nightmare. Banksy decided to have a shot at that same raw footage. To get Terry out of his hair, he told the Frenchman to go back home to L.A. and try making his own street art. This leads to the documentary's final section, in which Terry adopts the ridiculous nom de plume Mr. Brainwash and attempts to conquer L.A. with a massive Mr. Brainwash exhibition of paintings and sculptures in the mode of street art, which by then had become a hot commodity. In the last part, Terry transforms into a classic fool, both pretentious and empty, a cross between Peter Sellers' Inspector Clouseau and his Chance the Gardener from Being There. Where Warhol gave us a Campbell soup can, Mr. Brainwash gives us a Campbell soup spray can. Elvis Presley holds a Fisher-Price toy gun. Marilyn Monroe's Warholian silhouette is merged with Barack Obama's. The work is derivative of the derivative, which makes it irresistible to many would-be L.A. art world hipsters who turn out in droves. Some reporters have speculated that Terry is a fictional creation, an actor in an elaborate Banksy prank that began years ago to expose the faddishness and philistinism of the art world, and that now reaches its climax with Exit Through the Gift Shop. It's very possible. But if I and other enthusiasts have been gulled, I don't mind too much. An early skeptic, New York Times writer Milena Rysik, hasn't gotten to the bottom of it yet, but makes the case for why the film's reality is, in one sense, moot. She writes that the film, quote, certainly asks real questions about the value of authenticity, financially and aesthetically, about what it means to be a superstar in a subculture built on shunning the mainstream, about how sensibly that culture judges and monetizes talent, unquote. If Banksy had to manufacture Mr. Brainwash to drive home his points, the satire is too rich to make me cry foul. As far as I'm concerned, he can vandalize our movie screens anytime.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air.
NPR's business news starts with New Yorkers bracing for a strike. Doormen are threatening to walk off the job. This week, thousands marched up New York's Park Avenue, and some 30,000 building workers say they'll go on strike when their contract expires next week. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
For Enrique Kahlo, who works in a building on the west side, the issues are simple.
Fair wages, health benefits, and keeping up with the cost of living.
Building owners are trying to cut their sick days in half and get rid of the pension plan for new workers. Howard Rothschild is the president of the Realty Advisory Board on Labor Relations, which represents building owners. He says real estate taxes have gone up, rents have been cut, and apartments have lost value.
The state of the economy in general in New York isn't very good, and specifically in residential real estate, it's horrible. We need to find a way to run our buildings more efficiently and less expensively.
The average building worker makes about $40,000 a year plus $28,000 in benefits. Rothschild says that's a lot of money. Building workers say not enough to raise a family in the city. At the march and rally of 32BJ of the Service Employees International Union, Executive Director Kevin Boyle pointed to the buildings on Park Avenue. The bankers on Wall Street who live here, he said, with their bonuses, had one heck of a party.
Did you get invited to that party? But when we sat down and negotiated, they tried to give us the check. I ain't paying the check for the party.
The union and building owners remain far apart. There hasn't been a strike since 1991. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.